afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the meeting of the Socialist Party here in Clapham. You may wonder why they got this old fogey down from Norfolk, especially to chair the meeting. And I'm going back tonight, and I love Norfolk. But there was a reason I particularly wanted to do this, because Blake set off a stream of coincidences in my life. Like most kids born in London, one of the first poems that ever attracted me was Tiger Burning Bright. And I've still got, if anybody comes to my house, that poster, iconic poster on my wall. And he was also, for part of his life, a supporter of the Swedenborgian sect. And my son-in-law's granddad was a lifelong Swedenborgian. He is also a friend of Samuel Palmer, the poet, and having lived a good part of my life in Cambridge, anyone who's visited Cambridge and gone to the Fitzwilliam Museum would have been able to sit on a beautiful afternoon beneath Samuel Palmer's marvellous painting, The Magic Apple Tree, and dream away whatever kind of world you wanted. And also, Samuel Palmer lived in Shoreham, where we've had two of our greatest rambles, and my ex-flatmates had a fantastic gay wedding next to a hop field, the very places where Samuel Palmer painted. In addition to that, when I lived with my mum in Fulham, down the road was a member, a friend of Samuel Palmer's, lived down in North End Road, was Burne Jones. And my daughter went to the Edward Burne Jones School. And so all of these things connected in my life. Blake, Palmer, Morris, Burne Jones, all of them had a connection. And Blake has always been a part of my life. And I love poetry too. So anyway, that's enough. Today we're going to hear about the most important side of Blake to some people. Although I regard always poetry as something able to connect when perhaps revolutionary concepts fail. And they, of course, poetry can be revolutionary. So I now introduce our speaker, Steve Clayton, who's going to speak on William Blake, the visionary revolutionary.
Yeah, thank you, Richard. That was a great introduction. I want to introduce the talk by actually quoting another member of the Socialist Party. A comrade, Dick Field, wrote to me on the 12th of February this year. And this is what he wrote to me. He said, Blake was pretty certainly the first person in English literature to realise that what we now call capitalism was not just an activity of individual merchants and early manufacturers, but a system, one that had wide-ranging and very damaging social consequences. That understanding is scattered throughout his work, but concentrated in the poem London. Neither I nor my degree tutor could find any evidence of this kind of system thinking in any earlier writers. I think Blake needs to be better known and better appreciated by socialists. His writing is fathomless. No matter how far you dive into it, you never seem to be anywhere near the bottom. So hopefully I'm not going to be too superficial today or too in-depth, and I'll try and tread a sort of a fine line between those two extremes. So William Blake was a poet, a painter, but his job was an engraver. He's been described as a radical libertarian Protestant, rejecting the repressive aspects of Puritanism, and he advocated complete sexual and racial equality, a total fulfilment of human sexuality. I mean, his background is in the dissenting tradition, where the dissenters were against the established Church of England, Anglicanism. The dissenters were excluded from public life in the church and the state. Famous dissenters include radical Tom Paine, the scientist Joseph Priestley, and the anarchist William Godwin. So for Blake, after the fall, men and women were condemned to toil, poverty and suffering, oppressed by the church and the state, lord and king. The development of private property and the establishment of the state to defend it led to class society and class conflict, to a world of contradictions, humanity versus nature, capital versus labour, and church versus Christianity. The biographer Peter Ackroyd writes, he managed to combine an intense visionary belief in brotherhood and the human community with that robust and almost anarchic individualism so characteristic of London's artisans during this period. So a bit about his background. He was born in Soho in central London in 1757. His father was a hosier, a dissenter, as I said earlier. And Blake himself despised restraints and rules so much, even as a child, that his father dared not send him to school. I mean, Blake himself became a shopkeeper and a tradesman who sat behind the counter waiting for customers. And this is in a Soho of artisans, tradesmen, shopkeepers, the middling sort, such as engravers, carpenters, painters, cabinet makers, printers and dressmakers. And the dissenters and small tradesmen espoused radical politics. And his father voted for Charles James Fox, who was a supporter of the American Revolution and the French Revolution, who was involved in the impeachment of Warren Hastings, was anti-slavery, opposed to the King's Court, and to what was known as the Old Corruption. I mean, the American Revolution was opposed by the Old Corruption, the kings and the government, but was supported by the Corporation of London, dissenters, Wilkieite radicals, and merchants. So Blake's work was as an engraver. I mean, he was an artisan rather than an artist, a lower middle class tradesman, if you like. And it was described as a very profitable and reckoned among the genteel trades. Again, to quote Aykroyd again, Blake laboured for his bread. He was part of the first great period of commercialism and mass manufacture in English history. And he was one of the first casualties. I mean, Blake was obliged to carry on his trade as an engraver and not devote himself full time to poetry. I mean, he was not entirely unaware of commercial considerations. But all his life, he was both tradesman and artist, which is quite unlike his romantic successors like Keats and Shelley, where experience of the Industrial Revolution turned them irrevocably against commerce. This is a bit of originality of Blake. He actually created his own form of engraving, known as relief etching, where a letter or an image was raised from the surrounding metal rather than being etched or engraved into it. It stands up in relief against the flat plane of the copper plate to be inked and printed. Blake hit upon a method of creating creating words and images in a single operation. He put his artistic training to use and found a way of painting rather than engraving the copper plate. I mean, in some of his early works, each copy is unique and unreproducible by conventional means. In opposition to standardisation and mechanical conformity in printmaking and bookselling. So let's look at London and England in the 18th century. I mean, London was a violent metropolis. The heads of the condemned were rotting on the Temple Bar. There was public stocks. Soldiers were lashed in the streets. In 1780, the Gordon riots, there was a no-popery disturbance. Apprentices, servants and criminals joined in the burning and devastation. Aykroyd writes, riots by sailors, silk weavers, coal heavers, hatters, glass grinders were violent and bloody demonstrations over the price of bread, and the supporters of Wilkes and Liberty could muster such large numbers in London that the disturbances reached almost to the point of revolution. E.P. Thompson's The Making of the English Working Class is a sweeping people's history of the English working class in the late 18th century, early 19th century period. I just wanted to talk about one of his other books called Whigs and Hunters, The Origin of the Black Act. Following the collapse of the South Sea Bubble in 1720, there was an economic downturn and groups of poachers appeared in forests in Berkshire and Hampshire, stealing deer from the aristocracy. The Whig government responded with an act in 1723, which introduced the death penalty for over 50 offences. This act would not be repealed until 1823. The act can be seen as an example of bloody legislation against the working class. In 1688, there were only 50 capital offences on the statute book, but by 1800, there were 220 capital offences, mainly concerned with the defence of property. And between 1770 and 1830, 35,000 death sentences were handed out, with around 7,000 ultimately executed. I mean, some early influences on Blake. I'm not going to talk about Swedenborg because that's more of a religious aspect of the talk, and I want to steer clear really away from religion. But I will talk about Jacob Behmen and Paracelsus, who are in effect religious mystics. But there's a couple of quotes from them and their influence on Blake, and you can see, and I'll mention again Feuerbach and Marx, but I won't go into detail about them. Behmen said, "Heaven is in hell, and hell is in heaven. And nevertheless, there is neither of them revealed to the other. He to whom time is the same as eternity, and eternity the same as time, is free of all adversity. All things come into existence through the principle of negation. And Paracelsus wrote, the centre of all things is man. He is the middle point of heaven and earth. Heaven is man and man is heaven, and all men together are the one heaven, and heaven is nothing but one man. And this is very similar to the centrality of man in the criticism of religion by Feuerbach and Marx. If anybody was at my talk on religion last year, that's what I actually spoke about, was Feuerbach and Marx on the centrality of man. Also the ranters in the 17th century English Revolution, they wanted to break down the constraints of Puritanism. They indulged in obscenities, swearing, inversions of sanctified themes, the exhibition of nakedness, and in sexual license, and they expressed a belief in primitive communism. E.P. Thompson's last book, Witness Against the Beast, William Blake and the Moral Law, shows how far Blake was inspired by dissident religious ideas of the 17th century English Revolution. I mean, like the diggers and the ranters, Blake wanted to build God's kingdom on earth and to live in perfect freedom and complete equality. There's a nice little anecdote, which is quite exquisite. Visitors visiting Blake and his wife Catherine on Hercules Road in Lambeth actually found them both naked in their garden reading Milton's Paradise Lost. So the great event of the early part of Blake's life was the French Revolution of 1789. This was greeted with delight by dissenters, Foxite Whigs, radicals, the artisan classes generally. William Wordsworth wrote, "Bliss was it to be alive in that dawn, to be young, very heaven." Charles Fox himself said, "How much the greatest event that ever happened in the world, and how much the best." And William Godwin said, "From hence we are to date a long series of years in which France and the whole human race are to enter into possession of their liberties." Now Blake is much more expressive. "The fire, the fire, the fire is falling, stamps the stony law to dust, losing the eternal horses from the dens of night, crying, empire is no more." I mean, Blake called himself a liberty boy. He wore the red bonnet in sympathy with the French Revolution. He wrote, "The thrones of kings are shaken. They have lost their robes and crowns. The poor smite their oppressors. They awake up to the harvest." I mean, the French Revolution was a bourgeois liberal revolution. The lawyers were only prepared to extend political rights to property-owning white men, not women, the working class, or other races. Now, the influence of the French Revolution on early in the 1790s London was quite big. A lot of radicalism was actually inspired by the French Revolution. In 1791, the London Corresponding Society was established. Members were master craftsmen, shopkeepers, engravers, hosiers, printers. And they worked together with the revived Society for Constitutional Information. And the Friends of the People, another organisation, was established in March 1792 in direct response to Tom Paine's The Rights of Man. These English Jacobins had clubs, societies, meetings in taverns, in squares, the greens of London, and singing the Le Marseillaise. A book published at the time included, like Tom Paine's The Rights of Man, Mary Wollstonecraft's Vindication of the Rights of Women, and William Godwin's Inquiry Concerning Political Justice, and Caleb Williams. This is a world of early 1790s London that Blake was part of. I mean, William Godwin, Political Justice, one of the earliest anarchists. I mean, he believed that man is by nature sociable, cooperative, rational, and good when given the choice to act freely, and that under such conditions, man will form voluntary groups to work in complete social harmony. Such groups or communities would be based on equality of income, no state control and no property, a state of affairs brought about by rational discussion and persuasion. I mean, Blake is closer to William Godwin than he is to Tom Paine. In E.P. Thompson's book, Witness Against the Beast, he writes, "So if Blake found congenial the Paineite denunciation of the repressive institutions of state and church, it did not follow that humanity's redemption from this state could be effected by a political reorganisation of these institutions alone. There must be some utopian leap, some human rebirth from mystery to renewed imaginative life." I mean, in 1792, after the publication of the second volume of The Rights of Man, Blake supposedly tipped off Paine that the authorities were about to arrest him, and Paine then fled to revolutionary France. Tom Paine was actually an admirer of Adam Smith's The Wealth of Nations, a book I'm sure anathema to Blake, who very unlikely he would have read that. It's interesting enough that Marx saw that the rights of men to property espoused by Paine and adopted in the USA were not based on the union of man with man, but on the separation of man from man, and that the rights of man did not go beyond egoistic man. Marx writes, "It is not man who appears as a species being. On the contrary, species life, society, appears as a framework extraneous to the individual." So after the French Revolution and the political radicalism in London in the early 1790s, there was a lot of political repression by the British state. This is after the French people stormed the Tuileries Palace and the King of France's power suspended, his arrest, and then his ultimate guillotining. And Britain actually declared war on revolutionary France in 1794. Pitt was the Prime Minister from 1784 to 1801. Following an economic depression in 1794, unemployment increased and there were bread shortages. English, Hessian and Hanoverian troops were barracked around London. And in 1795, this is described as the year of the Great Terror. There was a climate of suspicion, espionage and intrigue in London. There were arrests, treason trials, transportations and executions. When the King opened Parliament in 1795, a huge crowd shouted, "No Pitt, no war, peace, peace, bread, bread." There was even a naval mutiny at Spithead in 1797. And then there was the rebellion in Ireland in 1798. The British state responded to all the radicalism with legislation, gagging acts, a traitorous correspondence act. Habeas corpus was actually suppressed. There was a seditious meetings and assemblies act. Combination acts actually made trade unions illegal. And this ended organised radicalism in London. The Irish Parliament was actually dissolved in 1800. Blake wrote, "The beast of the state and the whore of the church rule without control." Well, this conflict, repression and the urge for power, Blake described as the machinery. So let's look at some of Blake's ideas on the state. He believed that the state was a coercive legal order. He called it the stony lawgiver or stony law. And he refers to body of law as a corpse, a pun on the word corpus. In Blake's eyes, law leads to violence and social disorder. It requires prisons to enforce them, as much as repressive morality needs prostitutes. And remember, there were public hangings at Tyburn Tree at Marble Arch until 1868. For Blake, the state denies the potential in humanity. Like William Godwin, Blake sees political authority, power, as a source of injustice and inequality. Authority in all forms is the cause of evil. Blake wrote, "The whore and gambler, by the state, licensed, build that nation's fate." He saw that the state was built on military might, you know, armed bodies of men. For Blake, the symbol of the state, the symbol of Caesar, was the symbol for the state. He wrote, "The strongest poison ever known came from Caesar's laurel crown. Naught can deform the human race like to the armors I embrace." So he was opposed to authority. He rejects the state and the king, but also church and God. He talks about stamping the stony law to dust. Empire is no more. And again, he called the beast was the state and the church. I mean, the period of Blake's life was dominated by war. He was born, actually, at the time of the Seven Years' War in 1757. There was the American War of Independence, which also included war with France in the 1770s and 1780s. And then there was the War on Earth, as Blake called it, the period of total war, the French Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars, which lasted almost a quarter of a century. He saw these as harbingers of the apocalypse, a violent last harvest and vintage. Interestingly enough, the period of the total war, French Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars, I mean, casualty figures vary. After a bit of research, I came up with several figures. 2.5 million military killed in Europe, 1 million civilians. But then that's been disagreed with, and there's even figures of 5 million and up to 7 million killed. I mean, I know these figures pale in comparison to the 20th century. But this is early mechanisation, so war hasn't been fully mechanised. I mean, war caused bread riots in London and England, which were caused by bad harvests and Napoleon's European blockade. And grain was actually diverted to the army rather than to the people. And later there were more food riots in bad winters of 1812 and 1813. The blockade was still continuing. London was a city of famine. In Spitalfields, 45,000 people applied to be allowed to enter the workhouse. Blake sees war as energy enslaved. He sort of links repression and aggression, I mean, which is, again, is foretelling the 20th century and Wilhelm Reich's ideas. So he links warfare to repressed sexuality. He wrote, "I am drunk with unsatiated love. I must rush again to war, for the virgins frowned and refused." I want to note that bourgeois economists like Malthus, in his essay on population, actually welcomes wars, famine and pestilence as effective checks on population growth. I'll talk about Malthus a little bit later again. Now this section, I've just made up a title, I've just called it Critique of the Bourgeois Universe, or Critique of the Capitalist Universe, if you want, if people don't like that word, bourgeois. I mean, the rationalist philosopher Leibniz in 1710 wrote, "The actual world is the best of all possible worlds." And Blake wrote, "I read Burke's treatise when very young, at the same time I read Locke on human understanding and Bacon's Advancement of Learning. I felt the same contempt and abhorrence then that I do now." Just a quick aside, Burke's A Philosophical Inquiry into the Origin of Ideas of the Sublime and Beautiful is a 1757 treatise on aesthetics. And as on another side, Edmund Burke venerated the bourgeois revolution and the Whig political settlement of 1688. So Blake rejects the rationalism of Newton, the empiricism of Bacon, and the sensationalism of Locke. He calls these the false trinity of English rationalism. And this is the ideology which actually justifies the bourgeois revolution of 1788 and capitalism. I mean, the scientific revolution of the 17th century was the mechanistic physics, you know, the fixed laws of Isaac Newton. New science emerged to meet the material interests of the rising bourgeoisie. And Descartes freed philosophy from the feudal period, i.e. the Roman Catholic Church. Descartes saw the body as a machine. He wrote, he saw with the eyes of the manufacturing period. An interesting play by Brecht on Galileo has got some relevance here. In the play Galileo, Brecht writes, the iron foundry owner says to Galileo, "We manufacturers are on your side." And the university curator states, "How greatly is the science of physics indebted to the call for better looms?" Brecht believes Galileo is a social criminal. After his recantation before the Inquisition, Galileo becomes a servant of authority rather than asserting the right of science to transform the world for the benefit of the whole of humanity. For Brecht, science stood at the barricades of Galileo, but scientists betrayed their calling by neglecting their wider social and political responsibilities. I mean, The Life of Galileo by Brecht is really about the atomic bomb. I mean, and the concept of science for the people and the responsibilities of science to society. So science in the service of capitalism has deadly effects. I'm always reminded of Sophocles' line in Oedipus Rex, where he writes, "Alas, how terrible is wisdom when it brings no profit to the wise." So the dominant rationalism of Newton and the empiricism of Locke made people see only the ratio, according to Blake, and themselves, and not the infinite in all things. So Blake opposes this separation of mind and body that Descartes had proposed. A description of Blake is as a monist idealist. He doesn't separate the mind and the body. For Blake, reason becomes eurizon. This is a name he gives to the god of reason. And eurizon is very similar to the word horizon. And an horizon limits things. So he's talking about limits to humanity. So he's very critical of the faculty of reason because it controls the passions and it serves self-interest. Instrumental analytical reason can destroy what it dissects. And he argues that, and also argues that ends justify the means, which is anathema to Blake. I mean, that's Machiavelli in All the Actions of All Men, One Judges by the Result. So Blake abhors reason, which acts as an abstract objecting power that negatives everything. He also writes, "The spectre is the reasoning power in man, and when separated from imagination and closing itself in steel in a ratio of the things of memory, it thence frames laws and moralities to destroy imagination, the divine body, by martyrdoms and wars." So for Blake, the dimensions of material existence are a prison, a reality in which the Newtonian concepts of space and time rule. He wants to cast off Bacon, Locke and Newton. Locke and Bacon, they mock inspiration and vision for Blake. So just a quick word about John Locke. I mentioned him a few times there. His work is a defence of government and the state as a protector of private property. It's the dominant ideology of the capitalist revolution. I mean, he wrote, "Master and servant are names as old as history, for a free man makes himself a servant to another by selling him for a certain time. The service he undertakes to do in exchange for wages he is to receive in the contract between them in civil society, the chief end whereof is the preservation of property." I mean, Blake called this stern philosophy. I mentioned Isaac Newton. We know about Isaac Newton and the theory of gravitation. Blake, I'm not going to talk too much about Blake's paintings, I'm going to be talking about the poetry, but I do want to mention one painting, which is called Newton Measuring the Ratio, which Blake painted in 1795. In the painting, Newton is actually the god of reason, Urizen, and Newton is surrounded by the waters of materialism, and with his compass he divides the material world. So Urizen, or Newton, is measuring out the abyss with a rule and a compass, creating shape and number. And in this picture, the straight lines and sharp angles of Newton's profile suggest that he cannot see beyond the rules of the compass. Behind him, the colourful textured rock may be seen to represent the creative world to which he is blind. Again, to quote Blake, I quoted this earlier, "He who sees the ratio only sees himself only." So the ratio, the generalisation, this use of abstract reason, it represents the dividing rule and the scales of abstract rationalism. I mean, Newton is Urizen, the horizon, limits to humanity. And Blake talks a lot about Newtonian voids. Technology, industrial production, and the moral law are part of the vast machinery of the Newtonian universe. Again, he calls a stony world. He wrote, "One command, one joy, one desire. One curse, one weight, one measure. One God, one king, one law." Blake was alive at the time of the developing industrial revolution and developing capitalism. He didn't describe it as capitalism. He used the word commerce, which we understand what that means. I mean, the virtues of commerce were celebrated in a large body of 18th century Whig poetry. For example, Young's 1729 poem, The Merchant. And Blake, as an engraver, as an artisan, the Industrial Revolution threatened his craft. I mean, the new factory system was the enemy of the artisan classes. Workers were becoming slaves to machines, or as Marx put it, mere appendages of flesh on the machine of iron. An alienation was developing from such work. Alienation from work, from nature, from other people. Lambeth, where Blake lived for a few years, already by the time Blake was in there, had a stone manufactory, a wine factory, potteries, dye works, lime kilns and blacking factories. This is England's green and pleasant land transformed into dark satanic mills. I mean, the mills were the first factories of the Industrial Revolution. And education and training was developed to produce docile workers to work in the new factories of the Industrial Revolution. And Blake writes, "I turn my eyes to the schools and universities of Europe, and there behold the loom of Locke, whose woof rages dire, washed by the water wheels of Newton, black the cloth, in heavy wreaths falls over every nation. Cruel works of many wheels I view, wheel without wheel, with cogs of tyrannic, moving by compulsion each other." So for Blake, wheels are symbols of Newton's laws of gravitation, which govern and constrain, and then they keep the dark satanic mills rolling. There was a famous automated mill on Blackfriars Road, just up the road. It was called the Albion Mill. It was the first great factory in London, and it ran on steam engines, and it produced 6,000 bushels of flour per week. And it burnt down in 1791. I mean, quite possibly this was arson. I mean, the independent millers, artisan millers on Blackfriars Road actually rejoiced. Placards were held aloft saying, "Success to the mills of Albion, but no Albion mills." So these dark satanic mills were led to the enslavement of millions of workers. So I mentioned again Urizen and horizon and limits to humanity's potential. I mean, Satan in Blake's mythology was just a form of Urizen. He was a form of the god of reason. And Satan was described as the miller of eternity, the prince of the starry wheels. And he was grinding out material reality in the same fashion as the mill on the Blackfriars Road. Interestingly enough, actually Tom Paine compared the universe to a mill. And this emphasis on mills, I think it comes from John Milton, because Blake is very, very fond of John Milton. I mean, in Samson Agonistes, John Milton writes, "Promise was that I should Israel from Philistine yoke deliver. Ask for this great delivered now, and find him eyeless in Gaza at the mill with slaves. this is a reference to Samson, you know, in Judges, where the Philistines seized him and gouged out his eyes and brought him down to Gaza and bound him with bronze shackles. And they set him to grinding grain at the mill in the prison. Again, Aldous Huxley's novel Alice in Gaza is taken directly from John Milton's play. So, like, the Whig supporter of the American Revolution was Edmund Burke. I referred to Edmund Burke earlier. Now, he was later an opponent of the French Revolution, and he became known as, an old Whig, and he's the father of modern conservatism. Now, interestingly enough, he did say in his reflections on the Revolution in France that the age was an age of sophisters and economists and calculators, which makes it sound like he's actually quite in sympathy with Blake, but not really. I think Marx is really spot on about Edmund Burke. I mean, he writes about him, he calls him the sycophant, who in the pay of the English oligarchy played the romantic lead against the French Revolution, just as in the pay of North American colonies at the beginning of the American Troubles, he had played the liberal against the English oligarchy. He was an out-and-out vulgar bourgeois. Marx writes, the laws of commerce are the laws of nature and therefore the laws of God. No wonder that, true to the laws of God and nature, Edmund Burke always sold himself to the best market. So to Blake, commerce is the enemy. Now, as I said earlier, Tom Paine actually saw the benefits of commerce, unlike Blake. And as I mentioned, Tom Paine actually admired Adam Smith's The Wealth of Nations. Now, for Blake, excessive concern with money was disastrous for humanity. So he talks about material riches and wealth and money, and he describes it as mammon. This is money is the great Satan, which again is similar to like Marx writing, money is the universal whore, the universal pimp of men and peoples. It's a nice quote from Blake, where he talks about this sort of like obsession with money and love for money that we have in our society. And he writes, a guinea is more beautiful than the sun, and a bag worn with the use of money has more beautiful proportions than a vine filled with grapes. A tree which moves some to tears of joy is in the eyes of others only a green thing that stands in the way. So let's have a look at some of my poetry. I'm not going to look at any of the epic poetry, you know, they're like thousands and thousands of lines. So I'm only really concentrating on the Songs of Innocence and Experience. And I think the Chimney Sweeper, there's two versions of the Chimney Sweeper, one in Songs of Innocence and one in Songs of Experience. These poems express the indignation at the use of small boys sent up into chimneys. I mean, this exploitation and poverty was associated with this practice. I mean, in the 18th century and the 19th century, chimney sweeps, children, were a visible sign of exploitation in London. They were also known as climbing boys or lily whites. I mean, the May Day celebrations of the 1st of May was a holiday originally granted to young chimney sweepers of London. And for this one day, they forgot their wretched existence. And Blake writes in the Chimney Sweeper poem, and because I am happy and dance and sing, they think they have done me no injury, and I've gone to praise God and his priest and king, who make up a heaven of our misery. I mean, the church actually condones the cruelty of sending small boys up chimneys. I mean, boys were sold to master chimney sweepers between the ages of 4 and 7. They left the poorhouse in batches or were sold individually by their parents for a 7 years apprenticeship. As Blake writes, my father sold me while yet my tongue could scarcely cry weep. There's a play on the word sweep there, weep and sweep. And chimney design in London meant there was a great demand for small boys who were forced into the small spaces of chimneys. In his poem, he refers to locked up in coffins of black. I mean, coffins of black essentially are chimneys. These boys would be scorched with fire, suffer suffocation, later physical deformity was developed, and cancer. In his biography of Blake, Peter Aykroyd quotes a contemporary report about a climbing boy nearing the end of his career. He's now 12 years of age, a cripple on crutches, hardly 3 feet 7 inches in stature. His hair felt like a hog's bristles, and his head like a warm cinder. So boy chimney sweepers would finish their work by 12 noon, and were then turned out onto the streets in rags. They were classed with beggars and vagrants, subject to sexual abuse by adults, and they made up the, quote, the greatest nursery for Tyburn of any trade in England. I mean, Charles Lamb, the Chimney Sweeper poems, as a contribution to James Montgomery's 1824 Chimney Sweeper's Friend and Climbing Boys album, which was a propaganda book against the use of small boys as chimney sweepers. I want to cross-reference, really, contrast, in fact, the Chimney Sweeper poems with Charles Kingsley's Victorian moral fable, The Water Babies, which some people may have read as a child. And that's about a chimney sweep but it contains numerous prejudices against the Irish, Jews and the working class. Ultimately, the Chimney Sweep Act of 1840 actually stopped the employment of children. The employment of children was endemic. I mean, I've just focused on the chimney sweep because Blake has, but it was endemic in 18th century and 19th century factories and mills. I mean, child apprentices were indentured property of the bourgeoisie until the age of 21. Another poem in Songs of Innocence and Experience, again, two versions. It's called Holy Thursday. Blake writes, "Babes reduced to misery, fed with cold and usurious hand." In these poems, the poor children of London were guided by their parish beadles for an annual visit to St. Paul's Cathedral to sit with the aged men, wise guardians of the poor. Again, the church condoning the poverty of children. And Blake attacks the presence of so much poverty in a land of plenty. Behind where Blake lived as a child, there was the parish workhouse in Soho. And this was supposed to house 300 of the poor, but was severely overcrowded. A report at the time said, "The stench hardly supportable, poor creatures, almost naked, and the living go to bed, to the dead." So Blake lived in Lambeth, as I said, and was near the Lambeth Workhouse and Asylum. I mean, Lambeth Palace at this time was surrounded by alleys and courts, which were a sanctuary for debtors. Later in 1815, Bedlam, the madhouse, was moved to Lambeth from Moorfields. Also, the Lambeth Asylum for Girls housed 200 girls aged 7 to 14 years of age who were harboured to save from prostitution as chicken whores, but instead to be trained for the new manufactories or for domestic service. Blake was always commenting on contemporary events. He commented on a bread bill being debated in Parliament in 1800. And Pitt, the Prime Minister, countered complaints of scarcity and proposals for lower prices with an insistence that the poor should be encouraged to diminish their consumption and that Parliament should act with proper temper, firmness and sobriety. So a quick go back to Malthus. I mean, Marx and Engels describe Malthus as a lackey of the bourgeoisie. I mean, Malthusian theories blame the poor for their own exploitation by the capitalist classes. And these theories could be used to suppress the proletariat to an even greater degree, whether through attempts to reduce fertility or by justifying the generally poor conditions of labour in the 19th century. I mean, Malthus was critical of the working class tendency to reproduce rapidly, and his belief that this, rather than exploitation by capitalists, led to their poverty. I mean, Malthusians influenced Whig economic ideas that were exemplified in the 1834 Poor Law Act, which is designed to force the poor to emigrate, to work for lower wages, to live on a coarser sort of food. And this Poor Law Act also initiated the construction of new workhouses, bastilles of the proletariat, as Marx would have it. Blake wrote, "The whole business of man is the arts, and all things common." So he believed in bread for all, a fair return for a fair day's work, an end to tax, capital and empire, and he rejected all forms of repression. The state, church and academy were no longer necessary. People should be free to cultivate their mind and imagination. He wanted an end to the state, the king, the church, God, masters and mammon. In an annotation to a new translation of the Lord's Prayer, this is what he wrote. "Give us this eternal day, our own right bread, by taking away money, or debtor tax, and value, or price, as we have all things common amongst us." Wait a minute. I'm going to move on a bit. So, I'm going to call this section Humanity's Potential. So, for Blake, humanity's rule by reason is the petrifying of the human imagination. Blake wanted to realise the latent potentialities in men and women. I mean, for Marx and Hegel, the realisation of the latent potential in individuals and humanity is what it is actually all about. I mean, Eric Fromm sort of paraphrased Marx and Hegel by saying, "We are not what we potentially are, or we are not what we ought to be, and that we ought to be that which we could be." So to be alienated is to be separated from one's own essence or nature, leading a life in which essence is not fulfilled or actualised. So alienation is the failure to realise the potential of humanity, to realise the world is not external to itself. But humanity's potential is actually involved with nature. So nature, for Blake, he had a sort of a holistic, interdependent view of it, that there was unity and diversity and an ecological sensibility, that human beings were not separate from nature like subject and object, were an integral part of the organic world of nature. And he wrote, "If the doors of perception were cleansed, everything would appear to man as it is, infinite. For man has closed himself up till he sees things only through chinks of his cavern." And this really sums up his view really of the world of nature. "To see a world in a grain of sand and the heaven in a wild flower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand and eternity in an hour." I mean, I don't think Blake actually liked Spinoza, but he's very similar to Spinoza's ideas of objective reality in nature, and that nature is the sum and system of all that there is, and that there is an interconnectedness of all parts of the universe, and humankind is an aspect of nature. So we as human beings have to transcend the normal human condition of understanding ourselves and the universe from a limited partial human point of view. We have to know ourselves as united with the eternal order of nature, or as Spinoza wrote, under the aspect of eternity. This has similarities to the Gaia hypothesis of James Lovelock. And also, Marx actually identifies that man lives from nature, i.e. nature is his body, and he must maintain a continuing dialogue with it if he's not to die. To say that man's physical and mental life is linked to nature simply means that nature is linked to itself, for man is part of nature. I mean, capitalism disrupts a link between humans and the rest of the natural world, to the detriment of both. Marx sometimes called this the metabolic rift, an irreparable break in the coherence of social interchange prescribed by the natural laws of life. And Marx concluded that communism is the genuine resolution of the conflict between man and nature, and between man and man. So before I just come to the conclusion, I want to look at one poem in particular. It's a poem called London, which is printed in this thing that I've handed out. It's only four verses. I'm going to quickly go through it. So this is the poetry class that I've been threatening all afternoon. Okay, so I want to look at, on the first line, the word chartered. I mean, this is related to commerce, and it's a direct commercial allusion to the organisation of a city in terms of trade. I mean, chartered companies were bastions of privilege, and monopolistic companies like the East India Company, which were hugely involved in the British conquest of India. Also, chartered rights, chartered liberties, the Magna Carta, they were at the centre of Whig ideology. I mean, Edmund Burke, who I spoke about earlier, wrote in his Reflections on the Revolution in France, "From Magna Carta to the Declaration of Right, it has been the uniform policy of our constitution to claim and assert our liberties as an entailed inheritance. But also, a charter of liberty is also denial of those liberties to others. It is bestowed by authority. They are not claimed as a right. Guilds, companies, corporations, which are chartered, are exclusive." Tom Paine wrote in Rights of Man, "Every chartered town is an aristocratical monopoly in itself, and the qualifications of electors proceeds out of those chartered monopolies." And he also wrote, "It is a market where every man has his price and where corruption is commonplace." Interesting to note that in an incorporated town, the 1661 Corporation Act and the 1672 Test Act, which imposed civil disabilities on Catholics and dissenters, operated with the most effect. I mean, Tom Paine himself would contrast these towns with the vitality of commerce in unincorporated towns like Manchester, Birmingham and Sheffield. So for Tom Paine and for Blake, chartered means exclusion and limitation. And they dislike the imputation that anyone had the right to grant freedoms and privileges to others. Like I said earlier, Blake shared some of Paine's views, but not in his faith in the beneficence of commerce. So if we look at line three, I think the mark marked. I mean, it's a reference to the beast, you know, and for Blake, those who worshipped the beast were the usurers, the rich, those successful in buying and selling. And it's a mark especially associated with commercialisation. In the second verse, final line, he talks about mind-forged manacles, which again is about referring back to that quote about the ratio and seeing only self-interest, sort of hypocrisy, dissent, the deceit, which lead to law and repression. In the third line, "In every voice, in every ban." Now, the word ban here, I mean, there's a number of interpretations of it. I mean, we all know about bans are read in church before marriage. Marriages in church, constraining for Blake, lawless love. I mean, the bans of religion, "Thou shalt not," writ over the door in his poem, "The Garden of Love." also the Ten Commandments are bans, they're prohibitions, aren't they? The Ten Commandments are what mankind and human should do or not do. And also there's the ban on the liberty of speech at this period of time, the persecution of Tom Paine and the rights of man. So for Blake, the laws of morality, they constrict, deny, prohibit and punish. In the third verse, we've got another reference to chimney sweeper. I mean, I've already spoken about the chimney sweeper, where his father and mother have gone up to church to praise God and his priest and king, who make up a heaven of our misery. On the third verse again, second line, every blackening church appalls. I mean, this could be a reference to actually at this period of time, churches were actually discoloured by the smoke of expanding commerce. And also, as we know from earlier in the talk, churches were complicit in the brutal exploitation of children and they were indifferent to the suffering of workers. Also, the word appall, I mean, a pall is a coffin or a cloth covering a coffin, a tomb. I mean, again, this is a link of the churches are linked with death. Third verse, again, third line, hapless soldiers sigh, and the fourth line, runs in blood down palace walls. I think these are quite self-explanatory. I mean, the state uses soldiers to kill and be killed in war. To quote Tom Paine again, all the monarchical governments are military. War is their trade, and plunder and revenue their objects. So the soldiers' blood is on the palace wall. It's like the guilt of the palace, the guilt of the monarchy is of the soldiers' death. But it's also a threat of revolution. I mean, the blood of the kings will run down the palace walls like it did in the French Revolution. And the final verse now, youthful harlot's curse blasts the newborn infant's tear and blights with plagues the marriage hearse. I mean, young women were forced into prostitution. London was a home for 50,000 prostitutes. The curse could be a reference to venereal disease, which would be then passed on to children, passed on to wives, and then physical death, syphilis. And the marriage hearse, I mean, marriage is a denial for Blake. Marriage is a denial of freedom, the institution of loveless marriages. I've actually not spoken about women, free love, family, and race. About that could come out in the discussion afterwards. Mary Wollstonecraft, again, marriage without love was prostitution. So I'll quickly just round it up. So Blake identified commerce or the then industrial revolution and developing capitalism as a system that had very damaging social consequences, that inhibited the development of humanity's full potential, and that commerce is a system of economic exploitation of millions. He identifies that the 17th century scientific revolution justifies the developing capitalism and is a justification for exploitation and the petrifying of humanity's potential. He identifies the repressive nature of organised religion, the repressive morality surrounding sexuality, the repressive nature of family and marriage. His views on the position of women predate radical feminist ideas of patriarchy. His advocacy of free love is revolutionary. I didn't actually speak about these, but they're in the conclusion. So he spoke about the role of the state and the war, law and punishment, and he even speaks of the importance of dialectics or contraries, as he calls them. I didn't actually talk about them. So his belief that humanity is part of nature is an ecological, holistic approach to humanity's place on Earth. He's even an animal rights supporter. So he proposes a unity of mind and body, the unity of imagination and reason, the unity of conscience and desire, the unity of rich and poor, the unity of humanity and nature, and the end of antagonisms between human beings. For Blake, the human essence is imagination. The individual realises his or her own potential. It is the liberation of the unrealised potential within men and women, living in a world of mutual aid and all things in common amongst us. He opposes the developing industrial capitalism, but he does not look backwards to feudalism, but to a new future of equality and freedom. And Blake was far ahead of his time in the 18th and 19th century, and he still is. Commerce or capitalism is still with us and wreaks its damaging social consequences all over the earth. I think it is justified to describe William Blake as the visionary revolutionary.